Inouye, please be seated.
Thank you. Call Ian Cole. Do you confirm that your full name is Ian Bruce Cole?
That's correct.
And you've prepared a brief of evidence dated 5 February 2021 for the purpose of this hearing?
That's correct.
And do you confirm that we make statements of fact, those statements are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yeah.
And if you could please read your summary on page 3.
Thank you. My experience as a recreational angler and angling guide includes 30 years angling in New Zealand, mostly in the south and the south of the South Island, covering central Otago rivers and lakes. While central Otago waters offer a range of quality angling experiences, many rivers and streams are seriously impacted by water takes for irrigation, leaving dry or depleted river reaches in summer as well as in river barriers to fish movement. As Mr. Peregrine's evidence outlines, this is a historical legacy from the Gold Rush era, which will be addressed by upcoming water policy changes once an upgraded water plan for Otago is in place. As I understand it, Plan Change 7 is required because a 30-year lead time for the phase-out of mining privileges runs out this year, but many consent applications for replacement RMA consents have still to be processed. PC 7 allows existing water takes to continue for a short period until a new planning framework is in place and resource assessment work has been done. In central Otago, the seasonal variation in river and stream flows is worsened by the very high levels of water allocated for irrigation and the lack of minimum and residual flows to protect rivers during summer, creating a range of environmental problems, including very low flows and a complete loss of flow resulting in dry riverbeds, excessive with weed growth, flatlining or depressed flows for long periods, and a loss of natural flow variability. Placements and bunds and weirs across rivers to take water create barriers to fish movement and entrap fish into irrigation raceways, while channelisation and gravel extraction degrade natural habitat features of rivers and streams. Rivers and streams are highly valued recreational resources, and the adverse impacts of historic mining privileges needs to be addressed within an environmentally sound planning framework and with good quality resource information in support. Plan Change 7 short-term consent option, including improvements proposed by Fish and Game, allows irrigation to continue without preempting long-term water planning.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. I don't think there are any questions.
Any questions? Okay.
No. How did you just finish that off then?
Just with the last point 20.
Oh, sorry. Okay,
just all the
so you've gone over to point. I wonder if mine's different from yours. My last paragraph is paragraph 19 in your executive summary.
Oh, okay. I do apologise on mine, unless I'll print another old one, but the...
So I finish off PC 7 allows irrigation to continue, and it finishes, it's a single sentence, and it finishes with the words, occurs within a reasonable time frame.
Okay, well, my apologies then.
Doesn't matter if that's your summary. It's all right. It was more or less the same, but just a little different at the end.
Mysterious.
Okay. All right, thank you.
But anyway, the copy we've got is dated the 5th of February, so that's the copy we'll work to.
The 5th,
and we've taken a note that there may be some slight differences from the executive.
I'll follow that up. I've got the same paragraph you've got.
Oh, okay.
All right, okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Thank you.
It won't be something and nothing, I think, for this exercise. So you all right with that? You haven't got any questions arising? No? You do? You don't?
Oh. You're talking to me?
Yes.
Oh. I have no questions.
Okay, good. All right.
And, I was focused on something else.
I saw that. Yeah. Okay, no, that's good. All right. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Cole.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the final witness is Mr. Farrell.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I don't think.
I've got everything, thanks. Do you confirm your full name is Ben Farrell?
It is.
And you've prepared three briefs of evidence for the purpose of this hearing, one dated 5 February 2021, a supplementary brief dated 23 March 2021, and supplementary evidence dated 18 May 2021?
I have.
Appended to the 18 May 2021 supplementary are your marked up additions to the expert conferencing statement on Schedule 10A4, controlled activity and restricted activity rules, and Objective 10A1.1, 4 to 6 May 2021?
Yes.
And do you confirm that where you make statements of fact, those statements are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
And where you express your opinion, you hold that opinion based on your experience and expertise?
I do.
And, Ma'am, I was going to ask if it would be helpful to enter the attachment I handed up this morning as an exhibit.
Would.
Produced by Mr. Farrell.
Just pause for a second. And so, I see. And so this represents the relief that Mr. Farrell now supports, so it's moved on from the 23rd of March document.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Yes, so if I could have you produce, so you're familiar with the document entitled Proposed Plan Change 7, draft amendments as of the 6th of May 2021, together with the yellow annotations shown.
Yes.
And so I'll just get you to produce it as Exhibit Fish and Game. I think it's probably one, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is, ma'am.
Exhibit Fish and Game 1.
Or number 2.
2? Exhibit Fish and Game 2. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Could you please answer any questions?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to start with your supplementary evidence dated 23 March. And in particular, paragraph 10A, Roman 1. And in this paragraph, you are providing some evidence in relation to the NPSREG and the NPSFM. And at the beginning of your paragraph, you note that you had some involvement in helping to prepare the NPSREG. What was your involvement in relation to the preparation of the NPSREG?
In 2010, to the period prior to the NPS being gazetted in 2011, I was engaged by the New Zealand Wind Energy Association as a planning and policy expert to work with, I guess, or as a technical advisor working with government and stakeholder representatives, I guess, on backroom drafting of draft versions of the NPS reg. So I was participating in the evolution of that document and providing my feedback. I'd also probably add that I was a member of the technical member of the group that produced the developed the implementation guide for the NPS.
Casting your mind back to that period of time, what was your understanding in relation to whether the allocation and prioritisation of freshwater resources was a matter to be addressed either through the NPSREG or other guidance, national guidance?
I have always understood that the intention of the MPS Ridge was not to cover off allocation and prioritisation, as stated in the preamble, because that would be dealt with under the direction of the MPS for fresh water, which, going back a decade, came out a month after the MPS for renewables. So the two are being developed at the same time.
When you think about allocation and prioritisation of freshwater resources, do you agree that long-term durations for individual activities might have the effect of allocating and prioritising freshwater resources?
Yes.
I want to ask you some questions now about the marked up provisions which have just been produced as Exhibit 2. Okay. Starting on page Roman 4, there's some highlighted yellow text. Now, I think I've understood the purpose behind this additional text, but that's the flag for the rule relating to non-complying activities for new uses of water.
Yes.
When you think about the structure of the RW, or the Regional Plan for Water, is it your view that it would be clear to users of the document that consent activity classification was being changed for those uses through use of this text?
No.
I want to move on now to the policy that has been recommended as the hook for the ecological flows table. So this is your recommended policy 10A2.4. Now, looking at the wording of that policy there, the end of the first line, recognise that proposals which, in combination with other water permits, breach the minimum flow and allocation thresholds in table 10A2.4. Just from a pure drafting perspective, would it be more accurate to refer to the table as the presumptive minimum flow and allocation thresholds?
Yes.
So, be it being breached, the presumptive minimum flow and allocation thresholds. Is that what you're saying? Or is that a change to the text that you're suggesting?
Happy to change the text to what I'm suggesting to as quote.
Breach the presumptive minimum flow and allocation thresholds.
In table 10A.2.4.
Is that where you were going?
Yes.
Yep, okay.
And that then lines up with the heading on the table over the page.
Yep.
And encapsulates that those are presumptive thresholds. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Now, looking at the policy and its intent, when you think about the table relating to ecological flows, were you in court when I asked some questions of Dr. Hayes?
Yes.
And throughout those questions, Dr. Hayes recognised that those thresholds didn't respond to cultural values?
Correct.
Nor did they respond to amenity values?
Correct.
Or recreational values?
Correct.
And so the ecological values in the table are a subset of the full set of values that will need to be considered when assessing applications?
Yes.
With that in mind, when you think about this policy, is there a risk that when it is applied, the focus will be exclusively on ecological assessments and the thresholds in the table, when determining whether effects are no more than minor.
Yes, in the absence of any other policy direction relating to those other matters, which is currently absent from the draft.
And so if we play that through, that potential risk may result in long-term permits that might meet the thresholds in the table being granted in the absence of consideration of cultural amenity and recreational effects.
I'm not sure about that.
There's a risk, though, given that those other values are not specifically referred to in this policy, that those are not seen as important values when determining whether effects are more than minor.
There's a risk, yes.
Now, just thinking about this policy and its application, it will inform the decision on notification. That's the first part of the intention with reference to section 95A 8B.
Yes.
And it will also inform consideration of whether an application gets through the gateway in terms of 104 D1A.
Yes, if the table's applied. I'll just add that the second part of the policy allows comprehensive detailed ecological assessment to be provided by an applicant or just those decision makers at those decision making stages.
When you then think about an application having made its way through then that gateway, this policy then would have no ongoing effect?
Correct.
And so when you think about the outcomes that this policy is seeking to achieve, and you think about the objective, is there a link between the objective as you are now recommending and what this policy is seeking to achieve?
There is a link. There's a link to the part of the first priority and the objective of the MPS for fresh water being ecosystem health.
So take me back to the objective and its objective version B that you are recommending. And my question is, where within this objective is your proposed policy grounded?
It's an aspect of the term wild. The bottom line, as I've sort of called it in my supplementary evidence, the bottom line of not compromising the ability of a new water and land plan to give effect to the MPS FM 2020.
So in a sense it's a subset of the requirements in that regard?
Yes.
And again, do you accept that there is a risk that the ecological assessment and the way that the policy is only focusing on the ecological assessment may result in those other values not being appropriately considered?
Yes, it's a risk in the absence of no other policy direction in this set of drafting for those other matters.
I want to turn over now to the table with the presumptive minimum flow and allocation thresholds. And I want to ask you about the text in the box on the bottom right-hand side. So just for the record, this box appears in a column headed abstraction from permanently flowing reaches of intermittent streams. And I'm going to be asking you about the allocation rate. Row in the table for streams not containing threatened indigenous species or significant salmonid spawning and juvenile rearing habitat.
Fine. So the allocation rate for what? You're looking at table 10A 2.4, correct?
Yes.
And I've got the third row down, allocation rate. And
right-hand side.
Flow allocations of no more than 25% or?
It's the or. So flow allocation rate exceeding 20% of the instantaneous flow at point of take if MELF estimates cannot be made.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought you said something about creatures. All right. Okay.
Now, when you think about that text, that's going to then be a variable allocation rate dependent on flow in a stream.
Yes.
And when you think about how water is abstracted from a surface water resource, do you accept it might present some practical difficulties to structure an intake structure in such a way that has a variable intake rate dependent on a proportion of the flow in a stream at any given point in time?
I don't feel I'm in a position to answer that. I'm sorry. I, as I've sort of alluded to or clearly stated in my evidence in chief, I have relied on the expert ecologists and hydrologists in the practicality of these standards.
In your experience as a planner, have you ever seen an allocation rate based on a percentage of instantaneous flow?
No.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Re-examination.
No, thank you,
ma'am. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, Commissioner.
I just wanted to follow up on the some of the evidence that we were given about the MPS for renewables and there's a suggestion that the water plan doesn't necessarily contain any particularly directive provisions that you might think about, but then we were pointed at the RPS in terms of going up the tree. You did look at this a little in your evidence, didn't you, I think?
I have... So in respect of the MPS for renewables, my starting position was effectively agreeing with and adopting Mr. De Pelsmaker's position and review of the RPS provisions. I observed through cross-examination the criticism through Trustpower's counsel of that analysis. So through my supplementary, I took another look and thought about the implication of the MPS a bit further. Where I landed was that there should be no need to go up to the MPS for renewables, aside from any relevance discussions on allocation and prioritisation of water being relevant. The recently adopted RPS gives effect to the renewables NPS. And to that extent, I don't think there was a need to go above the RPS.
Okay.
And then turning to the RPS, that's where I understand through some of the examination coming out of Mr. Moore that there's now some uncertainty as to the extent that the infrastructure provisions in the RPS actually apply to allocation and prioritisation of water. And I haven't seen a clear position, and I don't have a clear position on that. What I would say in terms of the RPS provisions is that, assuming they are relevant, I don't see them going much further than to provide for development. There is reference to protection of significant infrastructure. But if that protection is intended by the other planners you're referring to in terms of the evidence as being allocation of water to protect the investment, then I don't think the RPS intended to mean or to apply to water.
It would be good if you actually took us to the provision, if you set it out in your evidence, or just that we had that provision in front of us when you were saying that.
Yes.
If it isn't set out in your evidence, we can go to the RPS.
The RPS, yeah.
So
where would you like us to go?
Would it be better if we had the RPS in front of us? Maybe.
Yeah. What one?
I don't, but I have got the RPS.
Okay. And you might have been thinking policy 4.4.3, but you... on page 64 of the RPS...
In terms of existing renewable electricity generation, yes.
And so what was the interpretation thing? Because it's an interpretation matter, I think your last response was, you know, if protection, and I think 4.4.3 from memory was the only thing that contained the word protection, might be wrong, in terms of the RPS provisions for significant infrastructure. But if that's what you're thinking about, 4.4.3, the protection there, I noted that you didn't think was intended to cover allocation of water. So that's an interpretation matter, and if you could explain why you come to that view.
No, I'm going to withdraw, I think, what I said, because there is actually clear reference to recognising functional needs, including resource needs.
So whereabouts are you looking now?
4.43A.
Yeah, recognising their functional needs, including resource needs.
Yeah, where I'm unclear is coming from, I guess, the position or the legal arguments or examination that Mr. Moore put up, that the infrastructure does not include the water. But looking at policy 443A and functional needs, I would agree with any evidence, if you've seen it, that suggests that hydro needs water.
And is that in order to protect the generation output of existing?
Of existing, yes.
Yeah.
I guess just to round off and just to summarise where I got to with the RPS, limiting the duration of a consent of a controlled activity pathway for 6 years, I think is sufficient to provide for hydro, be it existing or new, and also to protect the generation output of that infrastructure in an interim period.
Gosh, a bit of feedback on that mic system. Oh, just getting a bit of feedback on the mic.
You said you were just answering the question about limiting the duration to 6 years in terms of this policy. I just got a little distracted. Could you just repeat your answer?
So I'm now saying that the RPS does seek to provide for renewable development and to seek to protect existing resources, and in this case including the resource, the functional
right.
need.
That's under A.
Correct.
In here, yes.
And I think Plan Change 7, through enabling the status quo to be maintained for a duration of 6 years under a controlled activity regime as an interim period, achieves both the provision for the infrastructure and protection of the functional need of existing infrastructure.
So you can't foresee a situation where there may be an argument advanced that the point you're just making in respect of the water plan and the interim period doesn't adequately address the NPS for renewables and try and take it up a level and perhaps even to part two?
Well, I think that's where the NPS for freshwater comes in, and the conflict between the two national policies, and my understanding that the NPS for freshwater is the primary instrument to direct how water is to be allocated and prioritised. The reality, as I said in this case, irrespective of whether it's the hydro argument or even the TA's drinking water argument, that I think you should be really alert to is the, while it's an assumption, is the real world action that we can anticipate, and that is the land and water plan being developed and notified in the next few years. And that's where I see the efforts around integrated management, land use and water. That's where the requirements of all of the NPSs relating to water use and land use that relies or affects water should be had through a tomato to eye and an off lens. So going back to your question, Commissioner, I do not agree there is a material risk in this planning framework if it ignores the directions in the RPS for renewables in terms of the operative framework. I think there is wide agreement the operative framework is unacceptable and doesn't give effect to the higher order instruments. I would go on to say, if Plan Change 7 is amended to allow or to intentionally make provision for some activities to have long-term durations, that will frustrate the ability to implement the MPS freshwater in an integrated an effective manner, in my opinion.
Is one way of looking at the operative MPS is as of that date that those provisions became operative, that the two MPSs, so one way of looking at the RPS, sorry, as of the date that it became operative, was that the two MPSs as they existed at that time, or as they were considered by the decision makers, were brought to account through the policy suite that includes for the policy suite for renewable electricity generation that includes policy 4.4.3.
Yes.
And what has changed since this becoming operative is that we now have a new MPS for freshwater management.
I don't think it's that we have a new MPS for freshwater management, because as I've said in my evidence, the concept of Te Mana Te Wai, for example, has been around almost a decade, since 2014. What has changed is that, I guess, the scrutiny of the adequacy of the RPS and the acknowledgement that it does not give effect to the MPS for freshwater, or...
You mean the 2020 version?
The 2017
version,
which is my understanding from the Skelton
direction.
Right.
So
that's where I'm coming from. So,
I want your opinion, not Professor Skelton's, though. And that's why I led with the question on the RPS, when it became operative, or at least the MPS is under consideration by the decision makers for the regional policy statement. Did they seek to bring into account the two MPS instruments? And I thought you answered yes.
Yes, I did.
Things have become a lot more nuanced under the MPS for Freshwater Management 2020.
Yes.
Yeah. And you would have heard discussion in the court that there's a general unease across a range of activities where more enabling provisions are required, and the court doesn't have a clear view yet as to what those activities are. So, you know, should there be an exemption for dams? Well, what dams? You know, that hasn't actually been brought to us in evidence. Should there be exemptions made for hydro? Well, what hydro? We know Pioneer's got assets everywhere. You know, does it include that or just some of the assets? And so, with Trustpower, one thing that we were considering and have no view on, so parties ought not to take anything out of it, is whether some carve-out should be made for the Trustpower deemed permits. Because the RPS did endeavour to bring to account the two MPS superior documents, and because also of the policy signalling by central government around its ambitions for renewables, for New Zealand to be 100% renewable energy, fully renewable by 2030. Yeah. Bringing those two matters to bear, is there a case for a longer permit?
Just dealing with the current hot topic.
Mm. Which is what? There's quite a few of them.
Yes, Your Honour. The hot topic of climate change and the need to achieve or the renewable electricity generation targets of the country, that's been around since since the MPS in a statutory context, MPS for renewables. So that's been around for a decade.
The hot topic being the domestic target of 100% renewables?
Or well, it was 90% back then.
So now we're 100%.
Now we're 100%. Yeah. At a policy level, in Otago, I think the only thing that's changed is the most operative RPS, which, and I'm unsure if someone's taken you to the climate change provisions there in the past and evidence, but you should look at those. Mm-hmm. So that is
4.2.2. 4.2.2.
And there's an objective, objective 4.2.
And I suspect I'm not going to find it. Oh, maybe I will. Hold on. What page reference have you got?
Oh, it's 560, CB560.
That does not have any specific reference to New Zealand targets, but Clause C potentially...
Oh, where are you? Clause C or
422C.
422C. Okay.
So that's a policy.
That's a policy, yep.
Policy.
Yep.
Encouraging activities to assist to reduce or mitigate the effects of climate change.
Yes.
Yep.
So and I think that's policy direction that could be used to actually, if your understanding is based on evidence that there's an urging or a pressing need or any need to...
to respond to climate change?
Correct.
Yeah. All right.
Then that policy is relevant to encouraging activities.
Might also be sub-policy for encouraging system resilience.
Yes.
And then that's to do with the confidence that generators have to invest in upgrade and maintenance of systems.
Yes.
Yeah, and that may be linked to the duration of a permit.
Yeah, so sorry, that was the first part of my evidence, was taking you to that policy, making sure that you're aware of that. It is relevant, and I think it's probably the only key policy direction in a RMA statutory context that I'm aware of that's changed over the last 10 years. In terms of duration of consents, as I said earlier, I think the six-year controlled activity framework is sufficient. Thinking about long-term investments and long-term risks and decisions, I see an opportunity in the land and water plan development process, and I'm actually surprised, for example, by Trustpower about the arguments being made that there is such a risk. Certainly I'm not convinced there is a risk that's material to their case. When I'm assuming if they're not, or at least I would have thought they should be actively involved in the development of the drafting of the land and water plan provisions. And so the moment that's notified, there could be a more effective regime for them compared to a potential consenting framework.
Mm-hmm.
So just to sum up, my response, I don't see the need for a duration has been significant, a long-term duration for them.
All right. Well, that was very helpful that you brought us back to that provision. Yeah. For climate change. And I understand what you're saying generally in relation to, you know, have they made out the case, I guess, as Ms. Baker-Galloway opened? And I think the answer, in your view, is no, because they can be involved in the development of the land and water plan and have the opportunity to reconsent.
And that's assuming there's nothing in the RPS, which I have had no oversight.
You mean the new one to come?
The new one to come.
Yeah.
Soon, yeah.
Soon.
All right. Okay. I was really interested in getting your thoughts about something which came up in yesterday's evidence from an ORAG witness, whose name I have entirely forgotten, but director of LAMPRO.
Ms. Scott.
Ms. Scott, that's it. And she said, for pragmatic and practical reasons, maybe there ought to be some staging and sequencing of catchments or sub-catchments under the land and water plan. And the way to achieve that would be through variable durations on these consents. And we've heard similar evidence, but not as developed as perhaps Ms. Scott's opinion. Well, maybe there should be an overshoot of 6 years to something like 10 years, because probably two reasons. Firstly, the volume of consents which will come in either after six years, so huge volume of consents to come in and will need to be processed quite possibly on a whole of catchment or sub-catchment basis, which is a tremendous body of work both for the rural community, you know, and together with the regional council and other people who are interested, such as Fish and Game. So that would be the first reason. The second reason is that there will be significant costs to everybody who's filed an application for resource consent to date, because they've had to go under two plans, you know, both the operative plan and Plan Change 7. And, you know, that's how this Act works. In one sense, it's that it just is as it is. But in another sense, those costs might be viewed as being higher than what you would have anticipated, because of the information demand in the notified Plan Change 7. And it was taking particularly the primary sector in the direction of having to... Well, it wasn't encouraging primary sector to go down a controlled activity pathway, because it didn't look any different from either fully discretionary or restricted discretionary under the operative plan. So there's been a huge amount of work for which... Now, I'm concerned that work itself will become stranded or will be overtaken by new policy imperatives in the land and water plan. And so an anxiety for that not to happen again, which is very understandable, and an anxiety, if you like, that the land and water plan will not be ready when the council hopes in 6 years' time. But even if it is ready, I guess, in 6 years' time, that farmers, it's not like you're going to switch on flick on a switch, and farmers will be able to seek new consents under the land and water plan. Yes, they will, but they must also quite likely have to think about their irrigation setup and their land set up, and that of itself may require them some time to do it, you know, particularly if they're, yeah, depending on your the interface between land and water and any controls and regional initiatives that come down, in order to meet the land and water plan, farmers will, yeah, there might be have to be some significant investment in terms of storage or changes to irrigation conveyancing systems, irrigation systems on the property itself, as well as actually land management. So So that's not going to be done just in 6 years' time. It'll require some thought and, you know, in terms of farmers getting ready. So that I think would be the second argument for staging and sequencing. Have you got any with that in mind, have you got any thoughts or any responses to that? Is it all off at 6 years, or is it staging and sequencing of catchments to allow farming community to catch up with new policy initiatives under the Land and Water Plan?
Firstly, in terms of the resourcing, which was the first part, understand of that matter, I haven't heard the council suggest there's a resourcing issue.
On their part.
On their part.
But there may well be a resourcing issue within the community.
There may be within the community. I heard Ms. Scott talk about her clients and what they will do. Not sure how to take that because they don't represent everyone and there's 6 years to go to think of, or 4 years from now to think about it if you to give 2 years' notice. But resourcing, we know it has been an issue that's been articulated in evidence. The response from the regional council is that they're aware of the issue and that they're ramping up. And it's now on board. So
I don't know that my question was particularly focused on ORC resourcing, though. But to be fair, I think what we've heard in this hearing and elsewhere is that there is, in fact, tremendous strain on those persons working within the water field just simply because of the demands nationally with the new MPS, NMES.
So getting to the staging and sequencing of catchments. And certainly I acknowledge the evidence from particularly the farming sector and the relativity of the cost and the lead-in times required and the anxiety and the stress about that. If done appropriately, in my opinion, with the development of the Land and Water Plan should be able to utilise all of that information.
Yeah, I would tend to think so, although there may be some thinking.
And so all of the effort's gone into a potential consent application, in my view, should be able to be looked at and used in a meaningful way and therefore not lost and not seen as a waste of time in the development of the Land and Water Plan. And so there is certainly opportunity in the Land and Water Plan to deal with the staging and sequencing and the resourcing at a catchment basis. So that's one option.
I thought about that. So Land and Water Plan can deal with the staging and sequencing. That's your proposition. And I heard Mr. Moore examine on that yesterday. But if I've only got a 6-year consent, so, you know, that's a fixed term. If there's staging and sequencing in a land and water plan, that may be beyond my 6 years, which then compels me to get another top-up, if you like, 2 years, 3 years, whatever the land and water plan says, which is a cost.
That land and water plan could theoretically include a rollover clause.
It's still an application for a new consent to replace an existing permit. So you'd still have to go for an application, albeit that, you know, here we might, you know, as in here we may get to a speedy and efficient process which shouldn't impose too much cost, but there's cost.
Theoretically, there could be a permitted activity clause.
No, you wouldn't want that. I think there's dangers. Well, no, there's lots of hushhooks in there.
Agreeing.
That's not for me to decide, frankly. Yeah.
Agreeing that at least at a minimum a control activity consent, so yes, costs. Another option you could embed in this framework a trigger or a clause that ties back to the objective. The objective is now, as planners are recommending, a tie to the Land and Water Plan coming into effect. And picking up on this risk that the council does not notify or does not have the new framework in place, you could embed a a clause in Plan Change 7 that explains what is to happen if to a resource consent so that it gets, effectively the duration is longer than 6 years. Lawfully.
Yeah. And so how do you do that?
Well,
lawfully. I've got a permit for 6 years. I can't, I don't think, but I could be wrong, but I don't think you can extend the duration of a consent. You've got to apply for
it. I agree with that, but in this framework, you could, I'm thinking, draft a provision that when these consents are granted, they are granted for a duration of 10 years, not 6 years.
Well, yeah, that's a possibility.
It's intended to be 6 years, but then there's a condition of consent which allows the overlap, the extra time, if a certain action has not occurred.
So I get my consent for 6 years or 10 years if the land and water plan isn't ready. Well, I don't know. Is that lawful? I don't know.
Well, the reality is the moment the land and water plan is notified, those provisions will have immediate legal effect.
Okay. So tell me about that.
So whatever those provisions say will be relevant to...
Yeah, but in this region they say that plan, this plan doesn't shouldn't be given much weight. Now I think I might take a different view on a wholesale application of that idea, but but that's what would likely happen, wouldn't it? The decision makers would be invited to give the new land and water plan a weight, regardless of the strength of its provision.
Well, if there was I'm thinking of a scenario where it's a bespoke matter, and it's dealing with this issue of the deemed permits. And the scenario we're talking about is a scenario where the council has not done something it said it would.
Well, I think there's two scenarios. Either the council doesn't do something which it says it was going to do, and there could be two reasons for that. One is that the RPS, the new RPS, gets held up in a court somewhere, or the new land and water plan gets held up, presumably in a court somewhere. Not that we're to blame for everything, but, you know, because the hearings will be extensive as well. But it'll get held up, so that's one scenario. The other scenario is that it's not held up. In fact, you get your plan. You get both of your plans. But farmers aren't ready on day one. Farmers are ready to respond when they know what the settled policy is and then need to start thinking about how to achieve it on farm, or in fact cross region, depending on what assets they're using to bring water to themselves. So that's the idea that we could just flick all farming systems onto a land and water plan, just but that could be the problem for the consent. You have the 5-year grace period, as is the case in Lindis and Coburn.
I do think behind all of this, it doesn't matter whether it's a resource consent or the impending policy or plan changes. The issue is here because of the actual impact of the taking of water.
Oh, I don't disagree. I just would like your view on... So the issue's not the merits or the need for change. The issue is how do you manage change in an uncertain consenting environment? Is 6 years as a drop dead date too short a period, either in relation to the need for asset change, if that's what's to come, or in relation to actually the RPS and the land and water plan being completed and fully operative?
My position is that 6 years is sufficient.
Why do you say that?
I say that because of my belief that this council will notify a plan change or a new plan that will deal with these issues. It will, or at least should, grapple with farm system change if it's required. As I've said in my supplementary evidence, my evidence in chief. I was talking about 10 years as opposed to 6 years.
So what was your thoughts on 10 years? Sorry, I haven't...
Sorry, so going back to my evidence in chief, I was suggesting that there should be a term no longer than 10 years.
Rather than
the 15.
Ah, yeah.
So going back to the notified version. I'm reasonably comfortable with a longer than 6 year time frame. I'm not wedded to that's just what the framework has been. To me, it's 10 years is a generation, effectively. I would have thought, I think I've said in my evidence in chief, that 6 years or the time until a new land and water plan is notified does allow lead-in time. I'm not across the evidence, if it's before you, that says 6 years is not enough time to allow farm system change.
It's the idea of what are you changing to, and whether 6 years... I mean, I would have thought 6 years is plenty of time to change your farming system if you know what your goal is. But 6 years, we're talking about is not 6 years on a resource consent where we've actually fully worked up all of our systems. It's actually 6 years on a plan which hasn't even been notified.
And I think what I'm understanding, the issue that you're actually raising is this anxiety and additional cost of having to do a new application when you necessarily don't know what it's for. Because
I think there's two things. It's one, you'll have to do a second short-term consent because the plans aren't there. So that's just cost upon cost, with this process being extremely costly, you know, because of the overlap on the plans and some of the unguided matters of control and discretion on the PC7. So there's cost. And then there is... So that's one issue. The other issue is it's just timing and sequencing when you've got all of those applications coming in, and where there is it seems to me it's likely to be a lead in time for infrastructure to come down in the future.
I think those issues are yet to be properly thought about. And that's the type of thing that will be thought about in an off process giving effect to the MPS.
Okay. I don't agree. I mean, what does that even mean in an off process?
Timing on target. That then relates directly to farm system change if it's going to be required.
If it's going to be required, yeah.
I wouldn't envisage, for example, a new water and land plan coming in and imposing such a burden on someone with a 6 year current water take permit to make them change their farm system before they have to apply for a new permit.
Unreal, but it might, you know, there may be this expectation that you'll apply with the new systems in mind, and some of the evidence we've heard is that actually some of the new systems were being rolled out, at least on the Kyburn, before the application was notified. And then they've had to do a lot more work since.
But until we've been through this limit setting process, state of degradation for the water bodies, what are the community aspirations, not just the applicants and the catchment groups thinking as to what's appropriate? We don't know the level of change that may or may not be required.
And I suppose the timing and sequencing of that change as well, because it may not... not everything may be required to be changed at day one, but over a sequence period of time. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Right.
But if you're finding that there is a need to really grapple this issue in the consenting, in the actual consent duration, then I think there should be able to be a way to craft a provision in this Plan Change 7 framework that deals with duration in a more specific way, the sequencing in a more specific way.
Mm. Okie dokie. Those are my questions.
Nothing to add, thank you, Your
Honour. Commissioner, do you have any questions?
No, I don't have any other questions.
All right, so anything arising?
No, thank you, ma'am.
Very good. All right, thank you, Mr. Farrell.
Good and Gaines case for now.
For now. And Mr. Farrell coming back?
Yes.
And he's going to be back for the joint witness
conference? Yes,
yeah,
yes. That's the Tuesday afternoon, I think, at the moment in the draft.
For both priorities and the other one?
Honestly, we've not engaged in it all in priorities.
No,
so I don't think it's the other one.
You know, it's a general invitation because if the court starts asking questions on, you know, writing, you might want to have your person in there, I think. Okay, no, that's really helpful. All right, well, thank you, and that's your case.
Thank you, ma'am.
I can see you at 2.
Yes.
If you're interested in priorities, you should be. Okay.
Yeah, no, permits, yes.
Yeah. All right, very good. And do you want to talk about what we were talking about, or you want more time?
Now, Ms. Mallop's been furiously working away on this. She'll provide an update as to the thinking.
I was wondering, Your Honour, if we are addressing this at 2 o'clock, whether it might be worth just spending a couple of minutes now, perhaps getting some more context around the...
No, I'm not going to give you context or two when I've got Mr. Page in the room.
Okay, that's fine. I just thought we might be able to have a discussion with Mr. Page before 2 o'clock.
Oh, I see.
We've been in touch with him during the day or during the morning, but that's fine. We can address that.
I thought you just wanted to point me in which provision. Anyway, so I'll give you the context at 2. When we have Mr. Page in the room, and it's not something that you need to have a definitive opinion on prior to next Tuesday, but it is something that you need to think about, and that is whether the rate of take is a deemed condition.
And I have been in particular looking at section 413 this morning, and 413 subsection 1, that a mining privilege or right granted under the Water and Soil Conservation Act is deemed to be, and we'll focus on a water permit, so deemed to be a water permit granted on the same conditions in the provisions of this Act. So if whilst the rate of take may not be listed under a heading of conditions in a deemed permit, and we've got situations where on a deemed permit the rate of take may be listed as a condition, or it's set out in the kind of not introductory material of the consent, but it forms part of the consent, but it's not listed as a condition. But if that rate of take was on the previous mining privilege or right under the Water and Soil Conservation Act, then it would be a water permit deemed to be granted on those conditions.
But is it a deemed condition? So it's a slightly different question.
And the deemed condition is referred to in section 413 subsection 2.
Yeah.
And then looking at the provisions referred to there in the Water and Soil Conservation Act. So if we look at section 4, for instance, which refers to water rate licences, that does refer to the quantity of water specified in the licence. So if there was a quantity of water, then that would flow through as a deemed condition.
Maybe.
Yeah, so maybe. That's the thinking this morning.
So I'll think about it over lunch, obviously, but
So that's just a maybe from me on that. I didn't see on my really rough look, quick look at it this morning, I didn't see anything in terms of those sub-clauses referred to in 4132, which clearly signal, as is the right, you know, as it does, for example, in contrast with the right of priority, rate of TAFE. There was nothing called rate of TAFE, and that, therefore, was clearly a deemed condition. So I don't want to be too tricky about this, but it's but really trying to get a view on it, yeah.
And it's the reference in section 4132 that it's every deemed permit resulting from a mining privilege shall be deemed to include as conditions of the permit such provisions of the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act.
So yes, yeah, and so when you go through, I think it's starting at section 4 and I haven't got it in front of me, and travelling through to section 13 at least of the Water and Soil Conservation Act, that doesn't clearly pick up rate of take as being a deemed condition for the purposes of a deemed permit under the RMA.
No,
except
it does.
Indirectly, I think you're saying,
yes.
Piss water in a race.
Yes, and it refers to the, so section 4 in particular refers to the quantity of water specified in the licence.
Mm-hmm. I see. And so the rate of take could be the quantity of water. And what subsection's that?
That's in section 4 of the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act.
And then historically, in terms of that quantity of water, has that quantity of water been brought forward on deemed permits as rates of take or something else?
I think there's
a smallest board out there. But
there's a mixture of rates of take, volumes. It's different across different. In terms of the permits that I've cast my eye over.
Okay, and that's where your thinking got to, Ms. Williams?
So I'm still struggling to quite get my head around what the difference is between condition and the deemed condition, so I'm waiting in the interest of Your Honour's context at two on that. However, where I got to, Your Honour, is similarly to Ms. Malhot, that section 4 of the 1971 Amendment Act certainly talks about the rate and quantity, the quantity as specified in the licence.
Okay.
So, thank you. So that, and similarly for section 5, which is the dam licence, which then refers through to section 21.2 as amended of the Water and Soil Conservation Act 1967. Again, that talks about the storage as defined at a particular point in time. So there is something there. It's just taking a bit of teasing out to get to, but there is certainly something which establishes that there is a quantity for storage for dams and there is a quantity which may be taken for the specified purposes for water race licences.
Mm.
And so, and that then, in my opinion, Your Honour, it is implicit in the application of Section 13, which is the exercise of priorities under the 1971 Amendment Act, because it's only the amount, if the superior priority holder wishes to exercise their priority, that must be contingent on knowing what that quantity is that they're entitled to take.
Mm. Okay. All right. We'll talk about that at 2 o'clock. Very good. 2 o'clock, we will give you a copy of Dr. Somerville's opinion, and we'll talk about that, what happens next. Yep. Okay, very good. We're adjourned.
Thank you.
All rise.